the nature of reality. Really speaking, that is the essence of our life, really. What is the nature of this thing that we're involved with? This world that we're called upon to deal with and to make the best of. For a few years as children, we have a sort of an easy life in which everything seems to be well taken care of, but pretty soon we're launched into another realm where things become much more complicated. What should we do? And how should we deal with the various problems? So these are all questions that we all face. And somehow or other we manage to get through this life more or less unscathed. Most of us, many have problems along the way, and then the question is, why are we suffering like this? Why do we have to endure this? What is the meaning of it all? Where does it come from? Where is it going? What is the nature of this experience that we're involved in? This thing that we accept as reality, although that disappears every day, reality totally disappears. For certain hours, there's nothing that we can point to as being real. We can't point to anything for the certain number of hours. Every day we have to be totally unconscious. And yet we think that this is a wonderful state. Oh, yes, I slept so well. I slept well. I knew nothing. That's the standard. Even in the traditional scriptures, it's talked that way. I slept well. I knew nothing. Ah, how wonderful. But is it really wonderful? We knew nothing. So what was so wonderful about it? Is it wonderful to simply disappear? Is nothingness wonderful? As long as we can think about it and make a decision about it, then nothingness is never wonderful. But when we're experiencing it, we don't know anything either. Afterwards we say, ah, it was so wonderful. But you don't know that it was wonderful. All you know, when you got up from it, when you woke up from it, you felt refreshed. But what the experience itself was, we have no idea. And yet, without it, we cannot manage for very many days. Very quickly, if we don't get sound sleep, we go to the doctor and we get this pill and this liquid and that liquid, somehow to reach that state of annihilation, really. We're annihilated for a certain number of hours every day. But that is the best that normally we can manage. But is that really, does that really show us a deeper state, a more profound state of existence? Not really, it doesn't. It's a state of temporary annihilation. But somehow that makes us feel very good. When this world totally vanishes, normally we think that when we pass away, this somehow we're totally disconnected with this world, and with that is considered a horrible state. Yet every day we yearn to get into that state when we are totally annihilated. That shows a level of confusion in our minds. It shows that this is the best we can do, but it certainly doesn't show a perfect or a desirable condition. So the question is there anything better? Is there anything more profound, more significant? And of course, the religions of the world insist, yes, yes, there is. But in order to experience that, it doesn't come so easily. There are certain things that are required. And each particular religion has its own requirements. But the promise is, oh yes, this is a much better state of existence. This is in conformity with the universal law and the universal lawgiver. So that is the promise. Now, one of the conditions of that, what we are seeking is, if it only lasts for a brief while, then it is not much better than a pill that we can take, or some different form of medicine. What we want is something that is going to last for a long time. This is called in-flight refueling. Thank you. So, what does the Vedantic tradition tell us about these things? And there it's very boldly stated. There's no attempt to soften the statement at all. The statement is simply made boldly, and I'll read the Sanskrit to begin with. Sarvam kalidam brahma, sarvam kalu idam brahma, sarvam all, kalu indeed, idam all this Brahman is Brahman. Anyway, we don't know what Brahman is. So far it doesn't really give us any more profound idea in that respect. But what it does is it tells you that some people in the tradition have experienced something that is the essence of everything. They call it Brahman. We don't know what Brahman is. But they say that the essence of everything is that entity, whatever the word Brahman may ultimately turn out to mean. So there is something. That is the first statement. That there is something here which is not obvious on the surface. It is not something that we superficially can see or experience with any of our senses. And it is not something that we can really achieve by a mental operation. It is nothing we can realize by our minds. I mean, you've got very abstract ideas in fields like philosophy, physics, mathematics, and very abstract ideas that require a great amount of preparation of understanding in order to really understand that significance. So this thing that we're calling Brahman, that is supposed to be at the heart of everything, is it something like this? Is it something that one has to go through a great deal of study and abstraction in order to achieve? If that's the case, then we'll have to do it. If the essence of everything, the heart of everything, the soul of everything, which by implication is also the goal, our goal to understand, because everything else disappears and vanishes, but this one thing is said not to disappear, not to vanish, the essence of everything. So by ipso facto, as they say, by that fact alone, it is something we should try to attain. But is it something like this that it would take an enormous amount of preparation in order to master? In that case, we could say, yes, we'll leave it to the philosophers, we'll leave it to the scientists, and they are able to do it. Fine, we will accept that there is such a thing, but it won't have much influence on us. It won't have much significance for us. What we're trying to understand is, what is the nature of reality? And that is, of course, precisely what all the sciences are trying to understand. What is the nature of reality? Now, who is qualified to study that? Who is able to? Is it only, the rare few who are able to try to delve into this subject? If that's the case, that's fine. We'll let them do it, but most of us most probably will not be able to reach that level. So the requirement that we impose on this search for the essence of things is not only that it be all-pervading, that it be present everywhere, that it be the essential ingredient of every experience, but it should be something that everyone, that is accessible to everyone. Then comes the idea that so many different types of people. Some people are very theoretically minded. They can deal with the underlying reality of things that's not apparent on the surface. Other people want a more direct experience, need a more direct experience, are not inclined to go after something that has to be dug for and attained after a great deal of effort and a great deal of concentration and study. So we demand that. We demand that whatever is the essence of things should be accessible to all who are interested in inquiring into it. Because if it is not, if it's meant for only a few, then we don't gain anything. Most likely we won't be among those few. So does such a thing exist? And these scriptures say that it does exist. Sarvam khalu idam brahma. All of this really is Brahman. That is to say, it is something. What is Brahman? Why did they use the word Brahman? Brahman, it comes from the root brh, meaning something that grows. Grows without limit. By implication, is vast. So it is something which is all-pervading, something that includes everything, something that is included in everything. So the question is there such a thing, and can we find it? The sages have made that statement. Can we also find it? Can we also get to that understanding? The implication is, if the first assumption we will make is that it is accessible to everyone. Because, as we said, if it's accessible only to a few, it has a limited import, and we may not be among those few elite who are qualified for this. There are some religions that say, yes, only the few chosen ones can manage to achieve that realization. But let us neglect that possibility. What we're after for, it wouldn't be worth our effort to find something that is available to only a few, because we may not be among the few to whom it is available. So there's no, it becomes a very limited thing. So we will take the broadest possible approach. And this statement, in the Chandogya Upanishad, Sarvam Kalu Idam Brahma, that's, they make that statement categorically. All of this is indeed that reality. That means it is within everything, it is the essence of everything, it is accessible to everyone. Tad Jalan Iti is the next statement. Tad Jalan. Now Jalan, Tad means that. That is Jalan. Now what is Jalan? Jalan is a Sanskrit compressed expression. Jalan. The word Jalan. It's not a regular word. It's a compression of three different ideas. A sort of a shorthand expression. Ja is the root to be born. So everything that is born, and then la is the refers to the root lead to destroy. So everything that is born and everything that is destroyed, an is refers to the root to breathe or to live. So everything that is born, everything that is ultimately destroyed, and everything that lives, in other words, whatever exists in this world, must be in these, fall in these three categories. It must have been born, it certainly exists for some time, and then it disappears. That is the nature of this whole universe, and that is the source, the very source of our problem. If things having been born and existing for some time did not disappear, we would have no problem. Okay, everything is here, it will stay here. A state of steadiness, a steady state condition will have been reached, and that this is the way things are, and we will be satisfied with that. So, but that is not the case. Every perception, every thought, every idea, every manifestation, Ja has come into existence and exists for some time. Li is destroyed after some time. Tad Jalan. Everything that is born, that exists, and that then disappears is included in this, that the essence of that, the reality of that is Brahman. Sarvam kalu idam brahma. So this is that quote from the Chandogya Upanishad. Now what we're trying to do is to find out what is this thing and how do you reach it. We'll assume this, that what the Upanishad said, such a thing, there is such a thing, it exists, it is, whatever exists, whatever survives for some time, whatever disappears, the essence of all that is Brahman. There is a reality, in other words, at the heart of everything. And that reality, it gives the name Brahman, but that reality is a perpetual truth, something that will not disappear. And if we demand that it not disappear, we also, by implication, demand that it has never been originated either. Because whatever has been originated, whatever is compounded, can be uncompounded. So if it was never originated, if it always existed, and is at the heart of everything, that is what we want to get. That is then the reality, that is our own reality, that is our own truth. In other words, within each one of us, there is something which was never born, which has survived, which survives right now, and it will never die. So the essence, but we know the body is going to die. We know the mind is going to decay at some time or other. Somebody says, oh, he is 95 years old and his mind is as sharp as a 65-year-old or something. You know, that shows that we expect that the mind is going to decay. But this statement is that there is in all of us, in everything that was born, maintained, and eventually disappears, there is something which was never born and will never disappear. That is the first thing we have to ascertain, that we are told such a thing exists. So then the question is, where do we go from here? First of all, perceive that reality, and how do we maintain our consciousness of that reality, so that our existence, whatever happens to us, the ultimate aim is whatever happens to us in this life, there is within us something which is not at all affected by it. That is the thing that is so attractive. Because whatever happens, that is the demand we are making, whatever happens to us in this life, we were born and certainly we will all die. No one has yet escaped that condition. And in this life, we are sometimes happy, sometimes neutral, sometimes unhappy. But whatever our condition, whatever our fate, there is within us something which does not die. So we should be able to say, I am not this body. Because the body has come into existence and the body will die. I am not this mind, because the mind has developed. When we were children, very young, we did not know anything. We could not, we had no facility. That gradually grew. It became very brilliant, and we became very well known and very effective in this world. And then slowly we find we're beginning to forget things, and things are not quite as sharp as they used to be, and maybe we have to be excused from some things rather than taking part in everything. And gradually, finally, the last indignity is, oh, he is so old and somehow he's still very sharp. You know, that is eventually, you know, this is, we understand, this will all disappear. So our aim is to find this thing which has never come into existence, which did not need to grow and therefore will never decay and also will never disappear. Is there such a thing? And this statement, these statements from the Upanishad say that there is that reality, it exists. So the supreme question comes, how is it that we how are we going to be able to experience it? Are we going to be able to experience is the first thing. Then the question is, how do we get there? And the question of whether it can be experienced or not is given by the exemplars that we have before us. That is to say, these great souls who have realized this profound truth and have spoken about it, and they have assured us again of the reality of it, but that's again something that we have not experienced. We have not achieved that realization. At best, we can say, okay, we will accept their word for it, but that is only a beginning, and it doesn't carry us too far, because unless we can make some sort of a progress toward that, unless we can begin to actually experience a little bit of that ourselves, it's only of theoretical value. So this is the point, that there exists something undying within us, as we have, as has been assured us from these experiences. And there are methods which have been used in order to attain that. So now it's up to us to try to follow those instructions and see if this is correct or not. If only certain people are qualified to experience this and not everybody, then it doesn't really mean very much. It doesn't amount to much. Because if we are a part of that elect, select few, wonderful. But most of us probably are not, or at least don't seem to be, have no evidence that we are. So it doesn't, these things are of nice theoretical value, and we appreciate studying about the possibility that these things could occur. And that has its own significance. But the important thing is, can we realize that? Can we get more than just a theoretical analysis of this? So then comes the method of doing it. And those who have experienced these truths have left certain instructions or things that we ought to do in order to experience that reality within ourselves. And one of the profound ideas there is that if we can quieten this ocean of our lives, something is experienced. And so the analysis, the analogy is that of a lake. If you look at a lake, you can see the reflections off the surface of the water, but there's one thing you don't see at all. You may see reflections of all sorts of things that are around the shores of the lake. But the one thing you don't see is what is at the bottom of the lake itself. So the mind is compared in that way with that sort of a lake, which is, the mind is always moving. The mind is always in a state of unsteadiness. If we can make that mind steady, if we can make that the lake of our mind, as it were, quiet, what is it that we would see? The same thing as when we quieten, when the wind stops blowing on the surface of the water, if the water is very pure, very clear, you can see everything that's on the bottom of the lake. Now, those things that were at the bottom of the lake were not at all visible as long as the wind was causing waves on the surface. You could only see the reflections of the sky or the hills or the mountains, but you saw nothing of what was in the water. So this is the analogy that is given. If we can quieten our mind, we will see something within us. There will be a profound, we will see a profound reality, a basis, just as when the wind that is ruffling up the surface of the water is quieted, then if the water is clear and pure as it is in some lakes like Lake Tahoe, you can see everything on the bottom, every stone, every pebble on the bottom of the water of the lake, even quite a few feet down. Everything is seen with pristine clarity. Where was all of this before, when the wind was blowing, is saying we don't see what's in the water at all? Where was all of this? It was always there, but it was not perceptible because the water was being ruffled. So our minds are in that same sense. As long as the mind is thinking about this, thinking about that, planning this, remembering that, these are the things that we're interested in. But what is in the mind, what is in the essence of the mind, we don't see at all. So the techniques of yoga are intended to quieten that, the lake of that mind. And it's filled with all sorts of things. Our minds are filled with all sorts of things. Thoughts, desires, impressions, past actions that we remember that have caused, you know, further amplifications. And all of these things are constantly turbulent in the mind. Some things are positive, some things are negative. This is what we see. This is our mind. But that's not the essence of the mind. If that can be quietened, then those things are no longer seen. But what is the within the mind, that is what is perceived. What is at the core of the mind, at the core of the reality, that is the whole idea of meditation. Chitta vritti nirodha. The definition of yoga in Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Nirodha is the control or the you could say, or suppression or reduction of the chitta vritti nirodha, the vrittis, the memories, the impressions, the hopes, the fears, the desires, the all of the things that constitute our mind, all the things that are boiling up in us all the time. If we quieten that, what is seen is a reality which is hidden by all this motion. And that reality has no beginning and no end. And that reality is the core and the center and the meaning and the heart of everything that we call our life. Our life has two aspects. One, all of the turbulence on the surface, which consists of all these waves. And then the essence itself that is being that which is turbulent. When the turbulence ceases of that water that we're looking at, when that water is totally quiet, it is as though the water is not there at all. You really don't see the water. It's called mano nasha, the destruction of the mind. Actually, it's not being destroyed. It becomes so quiet that its presence is no longer an obstruction to seeing the reality that was being distorted by the movement. So the implication of that is that within each one of us, all the time, every moment, that reality is present. That highest significance, highest truth, highest conception that we're trying to reach, that stable, infinite foundation, which the scriptures tell us exists, is within us all the time, but not perceived because of this turbulence in our thoughts, our conceptions, and all the aspects of our mind. So when that, through practices of devotion, bhakti yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, raja yoga, so many different yogas are there, practicing all of that, the purpose is just the same, to attain that state in which we are not disturbed by anything on the exterior, and only what is within us manifests. In other words, can we ever reach a state of nothingness? The answer is no. And this is another one of the statements of the Chandogya Upanishad. Everything we get comes from the Upanishads, because the Upanishads over thousands of years have experimented with all these different approaches to truth and reality. And they have come to certain conclusions which have been again and again satisfied, again and again proved, again and again accepted. And so they have become authoritative, an authoritative guidebook. Sadeva somya idam agra asit. Agra, in the beginning. Before any manifestation, or let's put it this way, if you remove all manifestations, say you remove all forms, and you remove all thoughts, is there anything left? This world, it consists of sensations, perceptions, and it consists and it, feelings and emotions. There's a constant manifestations of so many functions, so many ideas, thoughts, feelings. Is there anything at the heart of that? Is there anything that, if you eliminated all of the sensations, if you eliminated all feelings, all emotions, is there something that would remain? And this is the Upanishadic statement. What remains is an indescribable reality. But it is from that reality, Tadjalan, like we were saying earlier, from that reality, all manifestation comes. Everything that we perceive, all ideas, all thoughts, all existence comes out of the statement is it comes out of a certain reality. It's the manifestation of different aspects of that reality. And if you eliminate all the manifestation, is there anything left? Yes, there is a reality that is left. And that reality is described in various ways. It is pure existence. It is pure consciousness. In other words, it is not non-existence. It is not unconsciousness. Normally, when we go to sleep, the happiest, we were saying at the beginning, the happiest time of day, unreservedly happy, is when we are sound asleep, and then we wake up, it was wonderful, I was sound asleep. But what is it that we experience when we were sound asleep? Nothing. In other words, is this the final, the ultimate statement of our of what we are aiming for in this life? No, because that it is, we really have not seen to the heart of it. We've eliminated all the manifestation, but we have not penetrated to the essence that is doing the manifesting. When we see that essence that is manifesting, that is called, that existence is also called consciousness, and it's also called joy, bliss. Why is it joy or bliss? Because there's nothing else there. The joy or the bliss is that which is natural to us. Joy is natural. Consciousness is natural. Existence is natural. We think when we die we're going to disappear in some sense. And then maybe reincarnate, okay. But every reincarnation, again, another disappearance. So if we eliminate all manifestation, what is left? Is there anything left? Yes, the infinity God is left. If we eliminate all thoughts, if we achieve a state of no thought, is everything gone? No, consciousness is there. So existence, consciousness. And if we eliminate all manifestation, is there going to be a very dull state, totally uninteresting? The essence of everything, that which makes everything else interesting, is the natural joy which is not dependent on any manifestation. A natural joy which is at the core of everything. So our natural state, if we eliminate everything, is a state which is totally satisfying. It is existence itself. It is consciousness itself. It is joy or bliss itself. That is what the Upanishad is talking about. And in order to prove that, the proof is left. The proof is what is called yoga. The proof is that which enables us to verify that. So these statements are not made as something that you have to believe or to accept. And it's wonderful, yes, we accept it, but we don't feel anything of it at all. That, whatever statements are made are verifiable. They can be verified, and there are techniques for verifying them. These are the various yogas. And what is it that they have achieved? For instance, what sorts of realizations have been attained? Then the Bhagavad Gita speaks of some of them. Samam sarveshu bhuteshu tishtantam parameshwaram. Parameshwaram, the Supreme Lord. Param is supreme. Ishvara is God, the Lord. This spiritual reality, the Lord being that Satchit Ananda, that existence, that spiritual reality, that goal, that inner yearning that everyone has for perfection, for joy, for beauty, for love, for fulfillment. That reality is to be seen everywhere. Samam sarveshu bhuteshu. In all beings, for every one of us, that reality exists all the time as the inner reality of our being. In the same way, we should be able to see that as we see the reality within ourselves, we should also be able to see it in others. We should be able to see it everywhere. Normally we only see either living beings or unliving things. In other words, we see material entities and we infer the existence of minds, a mental world. Psychological reality. At the heart of everything is that essence, that what we call God, the infinite reality, the substance of everything. is at the heart of everything. Samam sarveshu bhuteshu. In all beings exists that supreme reality. The andike vinashyat svanvinashyantam, that undecaying in everything that decays. All of us are, after we are born, we grow, and then slowly we decay, and then we disappear again. But in everything that grows and blooms and then decays, at the heart of everything there is a reality. That is the supreme, that is that consciousness, that is that joy. In everything, we should see not the physical entity, not even the intellectual capacity. We should see there's an undying and unchanging reality at the heart of everything. And how do we see it? The methods are the yogas. Now, in every yoga, what is called Raja Yoga or the yoga of meditation, we do that by controlling our thoughts, focusing on one object. But that object we focus on is something which is very dear to us. In other words, we choose, it's called an Ishta Devata, a chosen deity. In order to meditate effectively, we concentrate on something which we have chosen as our own highest spiritual ideal, that something that embodies the highest concepts of spirituality, purity, perfection, infinite joy, infinite satisfaction, all of that we associate with a certain being. It can be Jesus, it can be Sri Ramakrishna, it can be Buddha, it can be any of these beings. We associate with them that perfection. And though we imagine a form and we think of their manifestations, we think about them and we imagine about them, but what we're imagining and thinking about or thinking on is a very rarefied form of all the manifestations that we see in our life. So when you think of a very holy person, the very holiness of that person is something that attracts your mind toward its own natural holiness. It isn't that we're trying to do something strange or unusual. Our mind, our whole being is filled with holiness. We are in our very nature, we are purity, we are perfection. All glory is already within us. But we're distracted by things on the outside. So when we concentrate on a holy being who has embodied all the wonderful qualities that we want to achieve, what it does is it concentrates our mind on our own holiness, on our own glory, on our own perfection, which because of our obsession with external things, we're not able to normally concentrate on. But within each one of us is already that perfection in full. And when we concentrate on one of these perfect beings, like Jesus or Buddha or Sri Ramakrishna, so many examples are there, we're not concentrating on them as much as we are concentrating on our own perfection. It is because of our own perfection we are able to appreciate their perfection. So by concentrating on them, by meditating on them, by visualizing them as being actually present, when you try to visualize or imagine or think of one of these holy beings as you're praying to that being, you're approaching that being, you're trying to communicate with that being, what we're really doing is communicating with our own perfection, our own purity, our own holiness, which, because we're so attached to the ordinary things of life, we're not able to access. So we're transferring that, as it were, to these other beings, these other holy beings, and we're thinking that we are, I'm approaching God for and asking for certain, you know, I have certain troubles, I'm trying to get out of these troubles, I'm approaching God for a solution to my problems. Really, I'm approaching that reality within myself. That infinite consciousness, that infinite power, that the power to achieve anything is already within us, but we're not able to access it. So we transfer, by transference, we imagine these other beings, historical characters, historical personages, who have embodied this, and so we pray to them. But they are the reality within us already. So by praying to them, by relating to them, by feeling their presence, we are actually feeling our own holiness, our own purity, our own perfection, which is our own nature. Within the heart of everything dwells that Supreme Lord. That's what the verse in the Gita says. But in order to access it, we have to put it outside. In fact, that is the form of worship in the Hindu tradition. The Lord is present within each one of us. So when we sit down to worship, the procedure is first you imagine, you meditate on the reality of God within yourself. Then you ask that divine reality within your own heart to take a seat in front of you in the image that you have provided and to accept your offerings. At the end of the worship, you salute that deity that you have temporarily placed outside and ask it, that deity, to again assume his or her place within your own heart. So really speaking, it is our own selves we are worshiping, that reality within us. If that reality were not within us, the fact that it is outside would not be very significant, because it would have very little to do with us. It is only because that reality is fully present within us that we get an answer to this question: what is real here? What is, when this body dies, what is going to survive? That reality which is within our heart is the essence of our being. When this body disappears, that essence remains. Another body may manifest itself. That is, you know, in the process of things. Eventually we'll become so convinced of the presence, the continuous presence of God all around, everywhere, in all circumstances. We will be so aware of the reality that is constantly present everywhere that it will never disappear. So this is the attaining, this is the attaining of eternal life. It's not that one attains anything, it's that one realizes what one really is. We are not this body, we are not this mind. We are within ourselves, is that divine reality already? But we've become confused by the complexity of this world, so we think there's reality here. But actually speaking, it is the reality within our own selves that we are seeing outside or trying to find outside. And when we stop looking outside for this and begin looking within, within our own heart, then what we find, we get glimpses of that, which is always helpful. If we are in trouble with anything, God is always within. Within us is an infinite truth, which we can find through all these disciplines. But if we need any help from anybody or anything, we should first of all feel the presence of God within. And whatever we need to ask, whatever problems we have, presented to that reality first. And then see what happens. This is how miracles happen. It isn't that anything on the outside has changed. It's that we have realized that reality within is also present elsewhere. So these are the various ideas of trying to shift from a consciousness of limitation. Here we are in this world, subject to all sorts of limitations and subject to all sorts of constrictions and subject to death, subject to rebirth, subject to so many things. Actually, all of that is only the waves on the surface. Within is something which never changes. And that is something, the presence of that we can actually, and actually we do feel, but we don't recognize it. There's nobody who doesn't feel the existence of that reality. We definitely feel it, but we ascribe it to some other source, to some other purpose. So to change our viewpoint, that's all we have to do. There isn't anything else that's very magical that has to be done. But that viewpoint has to be changed. That thought process has to be clarified.